thank you for attending. This is session 356, titled Tarot, Mormonism, and the Fool's Journey. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue, so please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenters. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. So this session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and the scholars, and consider supporting the vendors outside as well. So this session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the session, for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin promptly with the next session. So about this presentation, the 22 major arcana cards of the tarot represent the soul's archetypal journey through life. These cards have a remarkable ability to illuminate reality, including iconic moments and figures in Mormon history, and to support spiritual growth. The core of this presentation will be an overview of the major arcana with commentary on the traditional tarot, followed by how they relate, sometimes with remarkable coincidence, to the significant events and individuals of early Mormon history represented in Joshua's depiction of the tarot. Sarah will also do a simple tarot exercise for audience members and conclude with a daring reading for Mormonism as a whole. Sarah Catherine Staley Hanks is a writer and tarot reader from Washington, Utah. She is the co-editor of Where We Must Stand, 10 Years of Feminist Mormon Housewives, an anthology of Mormon feminist essays. Her tarot work can be found on Instagram at cottonwood.tarot and www.cottonwoodtarot.com. Sarah lives in Layton, Utah, with her husband and two kids. Joshua Baird is an artist, musician, teacher, and filmmaker. He is most known for his oil paintings of the stunning landscapes found throughout the Colorado Plateau. Josh's work can be seen in various museums, collections, and galleries across the Intermountain West. For more information, visit www.joshuabaird.com. To learn more about the Mormon Tarot Project, go to mormontarot.com and facebook.com/mormontarot. Josh lives in Kanab, Utah, with his wife and best friend, Tara. And now for the presentation.
Thank you very much for that intro. So my name is Sarah, and Josh invited me to be part of this panel because I am a tarot reader. And can I just ask, out of curiosity's sake, who here would say they're familiar with tarot? Okay, cool. That's helpful. that's good to know for sure. All right, so a lot of this will be review for y'all, but that is just fine. A tarot deck is made up of 78 cards divided into two parts, the minor arcana and the major arcana. Arcana meaning secret or mystery. The minor arcana, structured more or less like a standard deck of playing cards, covers roughly two-thirds of the deck and offers wisdom on the day-to-day dilemmas we all encounter, important but not necessarily life-changing. The major arcana tells a story of creation and destruction, life and death and rebirth, self-discovery, self-recovery. Sometimes called the Fool's Journey, these 22 cards can be viewed as a life path where the figure from the initial card, the Fool, encounters mentors, rites of passage, loss, and triumph. This journey, found in the 22 cards of the major arcana, will be our focus today, and we'll be able to explore it through the lens of Mormon history, thanks to Joshua Baird's stunning work with the Mormon Tarot. Before we dive into each of the cards, I'd like to step back a bit and talk about what tarot is in the first place. the origins of tarot are controversial and somewhat mysterious. Devoted fans of tarot have proposed many theories over the years. I actually want to read something by a book by Rachel Pollack, who is a noted scholar of tarot. Pollack lists some of the many theories about the origins. The tarot depicts the sacred myths of the Romani, or gypsies, disguised in cards for the centuries of exile from the Rom homeland of India or Egypt or outer space. The tarot is a Renaissance card game inspired by annual carnival processions called triumphs. The tarot is a card game derived from annual processions called triumphs in honor of the god Dionysus, the creator of wine. The tarot conceals and reveals the secret number of teachings of Pythagoras, a Greek mystic who lived at the time of Moses and who influenced Plato. The tarot depicts the secret oral teaching of Moses, who received them directly from God. The tarot contains the lost knowledge of Atlantis, a drowned continent first described by Plato. The tarot is a card game imported from Palestine and Egypt during the Crusades. The tarot is a vast memory system for the Tree of Life, a diagram for the laws of creation. The tarot hides in plain sight the wisdom of the Egyptian god Thoth, master of all knowledge. The tarot shows Egyptian temple initiations. The tarot shows tantric temple initiations. The tarot preserves the wisdom of goddess-initiated witches during the long dark centuries of patriarchal religion. The tarot maps the patterns of the moon in Chaldean astrology. The tarot was created by papermaker guilds who were the last remnants of the Cathars, Christian heretics brutally suppressed by the Church of Rome. All of the above and more, tarot writers have proclaimed as the one true, authentic origin of tarot. This is still quoting from Pollack, but a little more pick and choose from different pages. Does it matter where the tarot really came from? If we now believe it did not come into existence until some 2,000 years after the ancient Egyptians, does that make all those Egyptian images and spiritual ideas meaningless? If the Kabbalist masters never heard of the tarot, can we no longer use all those seemingly perfect correspondences? To me, it seems almost the opposite. Those who have created myths of tarot origins have liberated the tarot from time. We can adapt whatever story or teaching or image fits to deepen our experience of the cards. The major arcana offers insight and connection to tales and rituals from ancient Greece and Egypt, and a Talmudic myth about two fallen angels. All of these come from long before the tarot's historical beginnings, and yet they match perfectly the card's essential story of the soul, its exile, and its liberation. I bought my first tarot deck in 2014 and rushed home from the bookstore to open it. I went through the cards and accompanying guidebook, not absorbing much until I got to card 16, the Tower. It showed a lightning bolt striking a medieval fortress, its top thrown off like a lid, its halls on fire. Two people are midair on the card, thrown to their certain deaths by the mayhem inside their once stable home. The guidebook explained, the tower is also known as the House of God, La Maison Dieu, and the tower struck by lightning can be seen as an act of God. In the destruction of the tower, what we have constructed as an unassailable stronghold, we experience in a flash the omnipotent forces of the universe. The description in the guidebook went on to talk about destiny, collapse, ego, and a total undoing of everything held dear. This card stopped me in my tracks because, strangely, I knew it. I'd never seen it before, never learned anything about it, but I understood it completely in an experiential way that can't be taught, only lived and remembered. The tower was the story of my faith ripped to shreds years earlier. The tower was the way I had gone into a Mormon temple, La Maison Dieu, at age 21 with all the certainty in the world, and walked out of that temple a few hours later to a world that didn't make any sense. The ceremonies in which I'd participated that day and the covenants I'd made under pressure may as well have been lightning and fire for all the damage they'd done to the life I was supposed to live. Reading that guidebook, looking at that card with the flailing people and the crumbling tower ablaze, I appreciated its validation. It seemed to say, you're being dramatic, because it was dramatic. That was the first deck I ever owned. I've worked with many since, and though each is individual, interpreted through the lens of the artist who creates it, some imagery is so deeply embedded in the soul of this time-honored mystical tool that it shows up in deck after deck. The tower often features castles and lightning. The fool often features a young person on a cliff. The hermit often features an old man with a lantern. These symbols connect us to what Jung called the collective unconscious, made up of the very archetypes on display in the major arcana, inherited from generations past and shared in common with every other person who lives or ever will. Tarot isn't hard to understand conceptually. We're talking about a deck of cards with pictures on them, and the pictures have deeper meanings. All you have to do is shuffle the deck, draw some cards, and see what you see. The magic isn't really in these rectangular pieces of glossy cardstock. It's in us. It's in our stories. We can see a line drawing of a castle on fire and say, I know what that feels like. I've been there. I'm still there. Then we can go deeper. We can unlock inner wisdom, find all the mysteries to the questions we've been saving up. The major secrets and minor mysteries, the arcana, live inside of us. This is how I've connected with tarot, as something like therapy, something like meditation, a tool for checking in with myself and supporting others as they do the same. It's not something I use to predict the future so much as to prepare for the future by better understanding the past and present. Most people who work with tarot consistently will tell you that it's magical, not in a figurative or metaphorical way, but literally magical. I believe the same thing, but I will level with you. I don't really know what magic is, and when I say that tarot is magic, I'm not sure what that means. Does it mean that there are supernatural forces and lingering spirits guiding your fingers to shuffle the cards in a certain way and cut the deck in a specific place, all so you'll see the exact right cards? Maybe. I don't know how the universe works, and I'm not ruling anything out. My guess, though, is that the magic of tarot is less mysterious than that. The magic comes from our interaction with these cards, and ultimately, the magic isn't found in the cards themselves. The magic is located within us. Tarot is magic because we are magic. Have you ever had a song come on the radio at the exact moment when you needed to hear it? Have you thought, whoa, that is some bizarre timing? It can feel kind of magical, kind of meant to be. Does it mean that the radio station itself is mystically led, or that the guitars and pianos and drums that made the song years before were charmed with spells and potions? Probably not. A more likely explanation is that we live in a magical world where strange, unlikely, beautiful things happen all the time, and we are magical people who take part in those strange, unlikely, beautiful things and have the ability to notice them when they occur. That's the kind of magic tarot taps into, the magic of existence. My theory of tarot is summed up really well in this quote from the book, At the Root of This Longing by Carol Leaf Linders. The knowledge and the truth and clarity we are seeking isn't out there at all, but deep inside. Certain insights want to break out into daylight, but we hold them down, fearing the kind of change that might take place if we knew them experientially and all at once. Down through time, we've evolved different methods by which these insights can emerge in small, manageable doses. We throw the I Ching, we deal out tarot cards, we analyze our dreams, and through these fissures in ordinary logic, we can, in effect, nudge ourselves along, self talking to self in a heavily coded language. This idea, the fissures in ordinary logic theory, is how I explain tarot's effectiveness. I think there are ways of knowing things that aren't about logic and reason and mathematical formulas. Using a tool that sidesteps ordinary logic opens our eyes to subtle clues, gut feelings, symbols, and when we're tapped into that kind of information, our intuition tells us everything we need to know. We've all got intuition, and it is so wise. When your intuition wants to say something to your conscious mind, it can be kind of tricky to hear. You might think of it as a still, small voice. We live in a loud, bustling world where information has to be backed up with data and pro and con lists in order to be credible, and in that environment, intuition will speak whatever language it can to make itself heard. Tarot is just one of those languages. So I hope that gives you a little, pardon me, a little taste of how I think of tarot, and certainly there are many different approaches to it that you'll find, but that kind of sets us up to get into the cards themselves. We're going to go through individual cards in the major arcana. From my perspective as a tarot reader and from Joshua's perspective as an artist who has created the Mormon Tarot. Before we get into each of the cards, I just wanted to invite a little exercise that you can participate in, you know, if you choose, it's up to you. But there's this numerological approach to tarot where because each of the cards are assigned a particular number, you can do a little math with your birthday to kind of figure out which cards are supposed to be, in some way or another, really meaningful for you. So, for example, with my birthday, February 23rd, 1987. If you add those digits together individually, you get the number 32. Well, there's not a card number 32 in tarot. The cards only go up to 21. So if you come up with a number that's greater than 21, you add the digits together again. In my case, 3 plus 2 equals 5. And card number 5 is the Hierophant. You can do the same thing with your birthday in each individual year. So for me, I'm in a year of the Sun, the Wheel of Fortune, and the Magician, using my same birthday, but instead of my birth year, this individual year. I hope that makes sense. You can calculate it out in your head or on paper if you want. And as we go through the cards, maybe just see if the card that is associated with whichever numbers you came up with just speaks to you in a special way. I have found that to be the case. So a little something for you to try. And on that note, I think we'll get into the individual cards.
Oh, you're good. I just want to, so my name is Josh Baird. I just want to thank everybody for coming. This is, I've been at Sunstone can everybody hear me okay about this distance? Okay. I've had a table at Sunstone for the last 2 years. It's been a great experience. I've met all kinds of cool people, including Sarah, and I'm really excited to be collaborating with such a linear thinker. Like Sarah, she did a great job. She actually just wrote a really great article in Catalyst Magazine this month. Was it the month of
July?
Anyway, check it out. And has a few of my cards, but I actually really like what she wrote. We're pretty much on the same page when it comes to tarot. There's a lot of different approaches, but anyway, so I'm really glad to collaborate with her. So I'm an artist. I live in Kanab. I'm more of a landscape painter. So tarot is a totally different world. Around 2012, I was at, I think it's called Pike's Place in Seattle with my wife. She was at a conference, and I was wandering around, and I found this place called Tenzing Momo. And actually, I bought my first two cards from this guy. I found him on the internet. And it's just a weird kind of a store, and there's all kinds of, it's like an apothecary, and there's tarot decks and all kinds of interesting stuff. He was a great guy. I bought these two decks. They appealed to me. The Aquarian Tarot is kind of an Art Deco looking deck. Has some great design. And the Hermetic Tarot just looked weird, and I just wanted to check it out. So I bought those cards and just started thinking about it, and I wanted to learn more. You may have read these quotes, but these three quotes sort of sum up how it all got started for me. The Joseph Smith quote, which I've always loved, just one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may. And I've actually written that in what's called the Deseret Alphabet on the back of the cards. So, because I think it says it all. And so I had this idea, and Brigham Young used to say, bring all the truths of the world to Zion, Islam, Buddhism. And I'm like, well, what about tarot, right? And then the Campbell quote, we've had what we call the Greater Jungian Society in Kanab, this like book club of about 8 people. We read books by Campbell and Carl Jung and Clarissa Pinkola Estes and things like that. Anyway, so we've been thinking a lot about Campbell. I've been thinking a lot about him. Every religion is true one way or another. It is true when understood metaphorically. But when it gets stuck in its own metaphors, interpreting them as facts, then you're in trouble. And like a summation of that quote, or another thing he said is, I think he said every religion is true from a mythological perspective. And that really got me thinking. sort of about this idea of a tarot deck being a mythological sort of telling of the story of Mormonism, or an archetypal telling of the story of Mormonism, sort of an archetypal map of Mormon history. I love this. You've probably already read it, but so Robert Henry, he is a legend from the Chicago Institute. He wrote one of the best books you could ever read about painting. So we asked Minerva Tykert, who studied at the Chicago Art Institute, has any artist told the great Mormon story? Minerva replied, not to suit me. I totally agree with her response. And he replied saying, good heavens, girl, what a chance. And in some ways, the Mormon tarot for me is sort of like, you know, it's my chance to tell the story. And I guess it's in my way, but anyway. So it's also sort of a family tradition. I had this article of faith card in my scriptures as a little kid until I was in high school. I had no idea my grandpa painted it. So it didn't say by Steve Baird on my card, but and then my dad and my grandpa, my grandpa was the lead architect for the Nauvoo Restoration Project, and they lived in Nauvoo for 6 years while they started restoring all the old buildings. And my dad and him built the scale model of the temple out of plaster that's in the visitor center, if you've ever been there. And then my dad built this giant model out of white bronze, which is the worst metal you could ever build. He learned that the hard way, but it was a struggle. He built that model out of white bronze, and it was on the temple grounds themselves for decades until they built the new temple. And then here's sort of my take. Anyway, so I think of that Hank Williams song. It's a family tradition. Anyway, so it's pretty obvious. This is one of the most striking parallels in the tarot. This is just an old drawing of Moroni doing the as above, so below pose. And here's the tarot card from the Rider-Waite deck that's just like the most classic tarot deck. And this is what I based my tarot on. And then here's sort of my take on it. But there's so many striking. In fact, all the tarot cards I created, I mean, there's, as I was doing research, there's a painting or five paintings of each of the tarot out there. There's drawings, there's paintings. Artists have already honed in on those archetypes. And it's just the collective consciousness like Sarah was talking about. They're just, it's a good sort of, archetypes are just great starting points for good art. Another one of the obvious cards. We'll talk about this card later, but the crown, notice the crown. There's a crown in the Rider-Waite, and the Nauvoo Temple has a nice little crown on it. So I made it kind of slipping off. Okay. How are we doing on time? Good, Sarah? I think Sarah's up.
So what I've done just for reference is included the name of the card, some kind of common themes from it, and some cards from my collection. Obviously, different artists will interpret the same card in a variety of ways. So in the top corner here, you have the Fool in a deck of mine that's plant-themed, and the Fool is represented by Dandelion. Down in the other corner, the Fool being represented by Joan of Arc. Just for example. So I'm also going to explain just some insight into the cards using the lens of animated film, because I think it's pretty relatable for a lot of people. The Fool possesses... Oh my gosh, my throat today. The Fool possesses the energy of the newborn. The Fool is both cosmically connected, new enough to hold on to the memory of the divine oneness from which he came, and fearless, possessing no knowledge of the world he is about to step into, and therefore too uninformed to be afraid. So if you think of the movie Anastasia, when Anastasia is walking on that snowy path and she has the choice to either go off in the direction she's supposed to, or she can go to St. Petersburg, and she sings this song about how she has to trust her heart. That's the feeling of the Fool, somebody who is, if only out of ignorance, has no choice but to trust their heart and follow where it leads. Traditional depictions of the Fool will often have a young person walking dangerously close to the edge of the cliff, carrying a satchel, a little dog trying to warn him away from the edge. That's kind of how the Fool works.
Thank you so much. So the Fool, like Sarah said, there's often a cliff or some type of threshold. And so the threshold I decided to focus in on was crossing into the woods, into the sacred grove. And my wife has this thing. She trains horses and stuff, and there's this idea of a horse knows oh man, I don't know if I can even say it. What happens before what happens happens. And that's kind of the fool card. So, Oh How Lovely Was the Morning, that's sort of the title I thought of. I focused in on, obviously there's all kinds of meanings with the tarot. I focused in on these ones in caps right here, naivete, risk, the moment before the first step of a long journey. Joseph said, is it Paula? Was it?
Yes.
Paula. I have a reader. Paula's going to read some of these quotes so you don't have to listen to my voice so much. Paula, would you like to read the Bible quote?
I can take my Bible and go into the woods and learn more in 2 hours than you can learn at a meeting in 2 years. Joseph Smith, Jr.
So he's got his Bible there, and we'll have a couple more, Paula. Go ahead and read, and then imagination. He's got his hand up here. No,
imagination. You. During our evening conversations, Joseph would occasionally give us some of the most amusing recitals that could be imagined. He would describe the ancient inhabitants of this continent, their dress made mode of travelings, and the animals upon which they rode, their cities, their buildings in every particular, their mode of warfare, and also their religious worship. This he would do with as much ease, seemingly, as if he had spent his whole life among them, Lucy Mack Smith. And the Seer Stone. Joseph had discovered two stones, one in 1822 while digging a well with Willard Chase half mile from the Smith farm, and the source of the other stone is uncertain. Richard Lyman Bushman.
Sweet. Thanks, Paula. So you'll see there's kind of a little lump in his vest there. That's where that Seer Stone is. And then up top, there's a bird. Is anybody a bird person? Anybody know what kind of bird that is with the gray wings? No. A mockingbird. I mean, that's... So for me, a mockingbird sort of represents synthesis. And so these three, sort of the Bible, imagination, and the Seer Stone, I kind of just thought that was appropriate to sort of... Anyway... All right, Sarah.
Yeah. Okay, and then we have the magician. In the magician, doors are opening all around you. Opportunities are presenting themselves. Your goals are being activated and made possible. In the fool, we say yes to the universe. And in the magician, the universe says yes back to us. In animated movie speak, I think of the film An American Tale. Cute little Russian mouse getting separated from his family, crossing the Atlantic. When Fievel meets the wise pigeon who tells him to never say never and to have hope for his future, that is very much like Fievel, the fool, meeting the magician. The pigeon is even wearing kind of like a magician's top hat. The magician has all the tools of the tarot available. You can see in the traditional depiction a cup, a pentacle, a sword, and a wand, which are all the tools of the minor arcana. And so there's a great deal of potential and kind of like just activity that's bursting forth in the magician.
So I kind of talked about this earlier, but I focused in on the Moroni visitation. And then the sacred objects. So the Rider-Waite, in fact, I think all pretty much in all tarot decks, the Magi card is where the suits are introduced. So in the Mormon tarot, I'm going to use the sacred objects as the suits. So you have the plates, and I'll just tell what they are right now. Let's see, starting with the Urim and Thummim, it's the Ace of Vision, and the Liahona, the Ace of Direction. The Sword is the Ace of Action. And the Plate's the Ace of Wisdom. So those are going to be the four suits. And that's pretty much all I have to say about that. But Paula, would you like to read those quotes?
Question 4. How and where did you obtain the Book of Mormon? Answer. Moroni, the person who deposited the plates from whence the Book of Mormon was translated, in a hill in Manchester, Ontario County, New York, as a resurrected being, appeared unto me, and he told me where they were and gave me directions how to obtain them. Joseph Smith, Jr.
The next one.
an angel of light who had on a loose robe of most exquisite whiteness. It was a whiteness beyond anything earthly I had ever seen. His hands were naked, and his arms also a little above the wrists. Not only was his robe exceedingly white, but his whole person was glorious beyond description. Joseph Smith, Jr.
Thanks, Paul.
Then we move into card two, the High Priestess. In a life that is constantly buzzing, that interrupts stillness at every turn, that is full of toxins and indulgences, we commune with the High Priestess when we are longing to detox and know ourselves. In a society that doesn't acknowledge the legitimacy of feminine power, here we are reminded. She is accessed through meditation in quiet moments. We cannot be fully formed human beings in the world without knowing ourselves in this way first. And the connection that I think of for the High Priestess is in the movie Pocahontas, Grandmother Willow, kind of that I think often with the High Priestess of like an oracle, somebody who is separated from the world in a way that allows them to have such immense connection to the divine within themselves. So there's a lot of quietness about the High Priestess, a lot of mystery. You can often see her sitting in a temple kind of setting. Connection with the moon, a moon at her feet, the triple moon goddess crown, lots of kind of mysterious, dark feminine power through the High Priestess.
So I'm hoping you're just guessing, you know, what I don't know. But obviously Emma is the High Priestess, and I think the fun part about this card was zooming in on, like, the decisive moment that sort of told the most about who she was. I'll try to be really quick, but so when Joseph is going to Carthage, he has no time to really visit with Emma. Emma's really worried. She says, "Joseph, could I have a blessing?" He says, "I have no time. Just write one yourself." So he writes a blessing to herself, and it becomes sort of this self-portrait of her. Her psyche, and it's called "The Desires of My Heart." It's this last quote, and we'll have Paula read that in a second. But that's what she's holding in her hands, and you see the candle being snuffed out up on the mantle. So that's kind of what I focused on. I love one of the most amazing things that I thought about focusing on was notice the B and the J, the dark pillar and the light pillar. I thought of Brigham and Joseph. You know, like she was the tightrope between those two people. I didn't include it, but I did include fire and ice, or fire and water. The ice cube was invented in 1844, or at least the ice trace. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Anyway, ice wasn't invented, but the ice cube. Sorry. right? And then there's just sort of symbols of hospitality, the teapot, the doilies. She invited so many people into her house. And that's all I have to say about that. Paula, go ahead and read those quotes. Thank you.
"Behold, thy sins are forgiven thee, and thou art an elect lady whom I have called." DNC 25. Emma Smith was the first wife of Joseph Smith, the first president of the Relief Society, organizer of the first hymnbook, catalyst for the Word of Wisdom doctrine, and mother to 11 children, some adopted, only five of which lived past the age of two. The desires of my heart. First of all, that I would crave as the richest of heaven's blessings would be wisdom from my Heavenly Father bestowed daily, so that whatever I might do or say, I could not look back at the close of the day with regret, nor neglect the performance of any act that would bring a blessing. Emma's blessing.
So she wrote her blessing, and Joseph said he would sign it when he returned, and he didn't return. So anyway, go ahead.
Next, we have card three, the Empress. The Empress is never depleted because she knows how to accept love as well as give it. The crucial flaw we make as mere humans and not perfect tarot archetypes is that many of us are skilled at nurturing and offering care to others, but do not know how to absorb it when it is offered to us. Her constant creative output is fueled by love, and her identity is informed by her creativity. The correspondence that comes to mind for me as a big Moana fan is Te Fiti and Te Ka in the film Moana. These two sides of the same being, the creation and the destruction that are so deeply interconnected. I think of the Empress as having an incredible ability to receive and a creative impulse that's just constant, just undeniable. A lot of connections with the Empress to Mother Earth, fertility, matriarchs, and the archetypal mother.
So I focused on Lucy Mack as the matriarch, the mother of Joseph. I mean, she would have had an immense influence on his psyche, his background and education. So let's have Paula read the quotes. Thanks, Paula.
Mother, do you not know that you are the mother of as great a family Mother, do you not know that you are the mother of as great a family as ever lived upon the earth? They are raised up to do the Lord's work. Joseph Smith, Jr.
Senior.
Sorry.
He was the patriarch. No, you're good. Okay. But he gave her a blessing on his deathbed.
All who consider Mother Smith as a mother in Israel signify by saying yes. One universal yes rang throughout history of the church.
And this was at a conference in Nauvoo, I think. So it's pretty self-explanatory. You have nature, flowers, orchard trees. The spinning wheel was kind of like this idea, like, oh, I thought of like the matriarchal lineage. I thought about African Eve, and it just popped into my head, you know. But the hen and the chickens, as a hen gathereth her chickens, you know, you've heard that in the Bible a lot. So that's all I have to say about that card.
Card number 4 is the Emperor. The holder of space and representative of institutions that bring order and balance, the Emperor works tirelessly and transparently so that others can feel safe. In its purest form, the Emperor's rule is egoless, coming from a place of loving responsibility and an understanding of healthy structure. In the film Mulan, the Emperor is the Emperor. I believe the Emperor says, no matter how the wind howls, the mountain cannot bow to it. The mountain is the Emperor. That force of structure, preservation, protection, holding space, and kind of showing up in the world. I think of the Grand Canyon, you think of redwoods, really taking up space. The Emperor is very connected with Aries, and so you can see on the Rider-Waite card, the rams on the throne there. So the Emperor is the archetypal patriarch, father of the tarot.
Okay, so here's Joseph Sr., the patriarch, and he literally was the patriarch, first patriarch in the Mormon church. Let's see. Let's have Paula read some quotes. Thanks, Paula.
So shall it be with my father. He shall be called a prince over his posterity, holding the keys of the patriarchal priesthood over the kingdom of God on earth, even the church of the Latter-day Saints. Joseph Smith, Jr. The Joseph Smith family was a Masonic family which lived by and practiced the estimable and admirable tenets of Freemasonry, Chateau Thierry. The Smith family believed in fortune-telling, warlocks, and witches. To be credulous in some such things was to be normal people. B.H. Roberts.
That's B.H. Roberts, who was, I think, an apostle. I think so. I'm pretty sure about that. 70. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, he was one of the early intellectuals. So this card it's really complex, but it's got... He had dreams full of symbolic imagery, so I thought about having all kinds of symbols. And all this stuff comes from early Masonic chairs and floors and symbols and stuff. So he's got his... Oh, there's so many things. He's got... Okay, so I feel like Joseph Sr., I'm not a historian, but what I've learned, I don't think he was a failed father, but he was a father who dealt with failure in his life. And I don't know, he had 5 sons or how many sons, but I think that was his sort of, you know, his, what he dealt with in life, his hardship. So there's just a lot of different nods to, like, there's a barrel of ginseng. He lost the family savings, the family fortune, after investing in ginseng and it didn't work out. There's some books over on the right side. I think he was a pretty smart guy. I mean, at least learned. He was an educator, and I think he was sort of intellectually adventurous. So there's some bottles down below. He definitely wrestled with alcoholism. They say one of the reasons Joseph didn't drink alcohol when he was a kid, when he needed that surgery, is because his dad was an alcoholic and he was trying to please his mom, and there was just tension around the idea of alcohol. That's what I've heard and read. So anyway, and the magic parchments, he had a little pouch. He commissioned a local sort of sorcerer to make some magical parchments and a little pouch. So that's what he's holding with his hand up there. So there's just a nod to all of this really interesting character from Mormon history.
Next, we have the Hierophant, which you could also think of as the Pope. You can see in the traditional card in the top center kind of all the vestments of a religious leader and some worshipers or, you know, devotees down at the bottom. The Hierophant has a lot to do with authority and community and tradition and kind of your connection to your community, to your surroundings, but also that question of how much authority you have over yourself or who will have authority over you. The Hierophant brings to the forefront the concept of spiritual authority. Who has it and how is it claimed? In an era where people are rejecting the dogma of organized religion in droves in search of a more personal connection to their spirituality, the training of the priest or the rabbi is no longer the only way to identify a Hierophant. And I know I've already mentioned the movie Moana, but I feel like if you ever want a master class in the Hierophant, the entire, all of Moana is like an incredible deep dive into this spirit of feeling connected and obligated and like you have a responsibility to your community, but also knowing that deep urge to follow your own authority and follow what's right for you and how ultimately those things don't need to be at odds. That's what I have to say about the Hierophant.
How are y'all feeling out there? Do you need to stand up and stretch? You're welcome to do so at any time. This is a wild ride, I know, but, you know, don't be ashamed to stand up and stretch or whatever. Okay. So the Hierophant, it's sort of a word that means pope or prophet or spiritual leader. The externalities of religion, I think that's an interesting idea. 1836 is what I used in the title there because down here, Fawn Brody, I'll just read it this time, Paula, no worries. At no time in Joseph Smith's career was he more at peace with the world than in the 3 years following the March of Zion's Camp. There were 3 years when things were pretty hunky-dory, and then it all started just tail-spinning. So this is sort of the height of his prophethood. There's the serpent cane. It's a cane in the mothers of the Daughters of the Pioneer Museum. It's carved to look like a snake, and it has buds carved into it. So it represents that cane from the story of Moses. You have his books of scripture in the background. And he's in the Kirtland Temple. Anyway, Paul, you want to read the first quote? Yeah.
God bless our prophet dear. May health and comfort cheer his noble heart. His words with fire impress on souls that thou wilt bless to choose in righteousness the better part. Hymn number 24, Bernard Shaw. Snow.
Perfect. So I did sort of, if you go to mormontarot.com, I did this, I aligned many of the hymns of the restoration from the hymn book with the tarot card. So there's a hymn for every tarot card, which is really, anyway, that. And I thought that was, now praise to the man is one you may have thought would be, but that's coming up. We'll get there.
Card number 6 is the Lovers. If I were to ever make my own tarot deck, I don't think I would call it the Lovers. I think I would call it the Twins. Partly because I think that to hear it called the Lovers does kind of seem to make it only about romantic relationships, when I think it's really much more about seeing ourselves through another person's eyes, coming face to face with ourselves through the medium of a relationship with another person. The Lovers. These dualities equal something greater than the sum of their parts. United by mutual respect, common ground, and clear communication, these partners amplify each other's strengths. They are both freer and better equipped to handle life's challenges because of their relationship to each other. The lovers is a discovery of self through connection with others. We are no longer at odds with competing aspects of ourselves. And the comparison that I think of here is Buzz Lightyear and Woody in Toy Story. I think sometimes it's only through our conflict with another person that we start to see within ourselves a little bit more, and kind of untangling that interaction can be really illuminating for our own, you know, our own understanding of ourselves. So yeah, that is the lovers.
So I chose to focus in on, obviously, Joseph and Emma, and this is more Kirtland after 1836, when the bank fails and everything starts to tailspin, and there's stormy skies. There's Joseph's holding her hand. There's some sort of botanical symbols down here. A lot of people zoom in on the mushrooms, like, oh, mushrooms, right on, like psilocybin. And, you know, there's that theory of Mormonism that involves psychotropic drugs. But the mushroom is a symbol of loneliness, isolation, and resilience. I mean, you think about it. They grow in a pile of dung. And when you read Emma's biography, that's sort of what, you know, she did not have it easy. And then over here on the right side, there's coriander, which represents the lust of the flesh. And then in the middle, there's some forget-me-nots, which represent true love. And Joseph's standing on the forget-me-nots, but they're not dead. And that's just a way of just trying to describe what was going on. In between them is a plant called a mock orange. And I put 33 blossoms on the portion between the two of them. The mock orange is a plant that smells like an orange, but it's not. And it's sort of a way of describing polygamous brides. And they would be in the future, because this is still in Kirtland. But I don't know if you read over here. Paula, you want to read the first paragraph?
My heart is entwined around yours forever and ever, my dear and beloved companion of my bosom in tribulation and affliction, from Joseph's letters to Emma.
So he definitely obviously had a way with words, right? But just the biggest gut punch, I think, in the history of Mormonism is that, according to the sealing records in the temple, Joseph was sealed to more than 20 other wives before he was actually sealed to Emma. So...
Card number 7 is the Chariot. Embodying rapid movement fueled by willpower, the Chariot shows us the mountains we can move when we are determined to get shit done. Unwilling to take no for an answer and singular in its purpose, there is no universe in which the Chariot can picture not achieving its goal. So the Chariot kind of, there's a theory of tarot where the major arcana cards are broken into three different lines. The Chariot kind of takes you almost from kind of like the innocent, idyllic world of childhood into like the real work of becoming an adult and getting to know yourself. The Chariot is sort of that decision to leave what's safe and what's known and go into what's not known and what is likely going to be a lot more challenging. With the Chariot, I think of Ariel in The Little Mermaid singing how much she wants to be part of the human world. She literally is not created to be there, but it's what she wants more than anything. And that force of will is, you know, she can't deny it. There's no getting around it. So that's kind of the spirit of the Chariot.
So I decided to focus in on strength of will, leaving safety, travel, conquest. And this is, I thought about, there's a literal sort of chariot, a handcart is a chariot, but I also kind of thought of the Mormon, the idea of the family unit as a chariot. Paula, you want to read the first quote there?
The fire of immigration blazes to such an extent that the folks are willing to part with all their effects and toddle off with a few things in a pocket handkerchief. William H. Kimball.
So these the handcart pioneers were mostly from Great Britain. They were totally naive to, you know, about like what they were getting themselves into. I have a relative, his name was Moses, believe it or not, that he crossed the plains in the Martin Handcart Company. He died after crossing the Sweetwater. He was helping sick people, and he was a 22-year-old guy. Anyway, this card was really powerful for me when I was researching it. Paul, I want to read the next two quotes.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. William Clayton, hymn number 30. They, the builders of the nation, blazing trails along the way, stepping stones for generations were their deeds of every day. Building new and firm foundations, pushing on the wild frontier, forging onward, ever onward, blessed, honored, pioneer. Ida R. Aldridge, hymn number 36.
I wanted to, thanks Paula, I wanted to just show, this is Independence Rock, and in the background is Devil's Gate. And then here's a close-up of Devil's Gate. So this is the pioneers were supposed to arrive at Independence Rock at the 4th of July in order to make sure they would arrive in Salt Lake City before winter came. And so I think that's maybe why they called it Independence Rock. They would celebrate the 4th of July there. And the Martin Handcart Company got there, I think, late October. So you can see in the background Independence Rock. I tried to make some of the cottonwoods yellow to just illustrate that. And that's all I have to say about that.
Card number 8 is Strength. Strength is all about going into a situation with an undefended heart. This archetype affords the realization that we do not always need to bulldoze through a situation to be heard or get what we want. Aligning with this benevolent force facilitates the gentle expression of the will in a way that is both effective and merciful. And the way you will often see it is a woman with a lion. Sometimes, you know, that changes depending on the artist's interpretation. But kind of a dangerous situation that is nonetheless undertaken with a lot of kindness and a lot of compassion and tenderness. And so the obvious correspondence in animated film world is Beauty and the Beast. Belle kind of forging this relationship with the Beast in a more loving, tender way rather than overtaking him or defeating him.
Okay. And Strength. I focused in on Mary Fielding Smith. It's called Mary and Little Joe Cross the Plains. Little Joe is Joseph F. Smith, who later became one of the prophets. And not just, there's the famous story about the sick ox, and I've heard that she gave it a blessing, and then I've heard that she didn't. And I'm pretty sure the latter is true. But I wanted to focus on just the whole idea of her crossing the plain with the attitude that she had. So, Paula, could you read that quote?
The man who supervised the cattle in the company urged Mary to stay behind, saying, "If you start out in this manner, you will be a burden on the whole company, the whole way, and I will have to carry you along or leave you along the way." Undaunted, Sister Smith told him, "I will beat you to the valley and will ask no help from you either." Mary Fielding Smith, Mother in Israel, by Jane McBride Choate.
I couldn't resist. I don't know if it's even great compositionally, but I put a swallowtail butterfly up there. I had a really interesting experience going down the Grand Canyon. I'm a crewman with Grand Canyon Expeditions. I go down every once in a while. We went down to drop some ashes in the river for a client, and with the whole family. And the morning of the drop, when we dropped the ashes, this swallowtail butterfly, giant butterfly, yellow wings and lapis dots, just floated around, and it landed not on every member of the family, but on like two or three people, and it was this really quiet, spooky moment. So Mary Fielding Smith was the wife of Hiram Smith, who was also killed at Carthage, so I put the butterfly there as a nod to him. And I just want to say it represents the strength of ancestors in Mormonism.
Card number 9 is the Hermit. The Hermit speaks to our innate desire to know ourselves well and deeply. One of the holiest energies of the tarot, he has turned away from society and the material world in search of a more meaningful kinship with the divine. At this point, other people cannot help us. We've gathered advice, acquired teachers, and formed an identity we can show to the world. In the Hermit, we examine the authenticity of that identity and shed the false self. So the Hermit represented with a lone figure carrying a lantern. I think of Elsa in the movie Frozen, at the point at which she leaves her kingdom and goes into the mountains to be by herself. Now, it's not a situation that can last forever. She will eventually return to her kingdom, but that time by herself is so key for like allowing her to accept who she is and come to develop her gifts. That's the spirit of the Hermit. It's the times in life when it's really not about other people helping you. It's about looking within and finding what's there.
So one of my favorite sort of Book of Mormon stories was this idea of I live in the desert. I love the desert. I've always loved the idea of Moroni crossing, you know, from Mexico to New York and stopping by Manti to dedicate the temple there and going through the, anyway, there's a church film that shows him. It's really dramatic and he's crossing the desert. And I just have always liked that idea. But so I tried to focus on historical Mormon history, but I had to have Moroni be the Hermit. And I think it also tells a lot about the Book of Mormon ethos and Mormonism. Plus I also realized, oh, he could have used the Liahona to find the Hill Cumorah. So I was like, oh, that's so cool. Paula, would you read the first quote?
My father hath been slain in battle, and all my kinsfolk. And I have not friends nor whither to go, and how long the Lord will suffer that I may live, I know not. Mormon chapter 8, verse 5.
So, it's the last of the Mohicans, right? Kind of, I don't know, I just love that. That's great literature, right? Pretty sad. Go ahead, next one.
We two were alone. President Young took me to the spot where the temple was to stand. We went to the southeast corner, and President Young said, here is the spot where the prophet Moroni stood and dedicated this piece of land for a temple site. And that is the reason why the location is made here, and we can't move it from this spot. And if you and I are the only persons that come here at high noon today, we will dedicate this ground. Warren S. Snow.
So if you haven't been to Manti, there's a bronze sculpture of Moroni. I think he's holding the plates, and it's sort of a sculpture dedicating this moment when Moroni supposedly dedicated the temple grounds there. So anyway, we have the Manti LaSalles, and you can see the plates in his backpack and the sword. That must have been a heavy backpack. Anyway.
Card number 10 is the Wheel of Fortune. There are a lot of cards in the tarot that represent the capacity for change, but none so fundamental as the Wheel of Fortune. When we invoke this energy in our lives, we become fully awake to patterns we repeat and are given an opportunity to break them. The Wheel of Fortune, as you would expect, has a lot to do with cycles and patterns, and so you can think of it in terms of your own cycles that you, like the situations you tend to get into over and over. You can broaden it out and say, like, what are the greater cycles that are operating here culturally, systemically? What role does fate play in, like, kind of developing my life? But there's always the sense with the Wheel of Fortune that this too shall pass. Things are constantly turning and evolving. The obvious relationship here would be to the Circle of Life from The Lion King, that things do constantly change, but the story is kind of always, the story is always turning, it's always renewing itself, just like the Wheel of Fortune.
So one of the things I was most excited about was to hear what Sarah would say about all these cards, and I'm loving the cartoon analogies. It's awesome. I decided to zoom in on the wheels of the handcarts and wagons. Back to the Martin Handcart Company story. I mentioned my ancestor Moses was there, you know, so I had to do another card about the handcart company. I think of it as just when good things turn bad, when bad things turn good. So we have the kids down below. And they're kind of wrapped up in a blanket, and then we have the rescue happening above. So there's kind of, the kids don't know the rescue's happening yet. They're still in that sort of moment of sadness, and then the rescue happens by a man named Joseph Angel, of all, what a crazy name. So I think it's so, just an example of when archetypes merge with like empirical reality. There's something super potent when there's, when we have that sort of, I don't know, dovetailing of the two. Paula, would you like to read the two quotes?
Many of our brethren and sisters are on the planes with handcarts, and they must be brought here. Go and bring in those people now on the planes and attend strictly to those things which we call temporal. Otherwise, your faith will be in vain. Brigham Young. The white mule was lost sight of on the white background of snow, and Joseph Angel, with his big blue soldier's overcoat, its large cape and capacious skirts rising and falling with the motion of the mule, gave the appearance of a big blue winged angel flying to our rescue. The scene that presented itself on his arrival, I shall never forget. Women and men surrounded him, weeping and crying aloud, on their knees, holding to the skirts of his coat, as though afraid he would escape from their grasp and fly away. Albert Jones.
I think Albert Jones was like a 12-year-old kid, and he had this dream the night before in his account. And the dream had Joseph Angel with the blue coat and all this stuff. It's really interesting. Anyway, so I thought one of those kids could be Joseph Angel. By the way, if you ever read about the rescue, it's not as simple as I was reading about it, and I thought, you know, people just went and rescued them. But they sent a team of people, and then they kind of got lost, and then they turned around. They're like, yeah, they gave up, and then they'd go again. And it was like this. It took like a month or more for the rescue to actually happen. Anyway, there's stories of kids leaning against, you know, a kid going out to gather firewood and then just settling down next to a wagon and just freezing to death. Anyway, it's just such a, what a crazy, dramatic sort of moment in Mormon history. I included the little kitten. I don't know if kittens cross the plains. I know at least a few did, or I don't know, but I did it as a nod to, I don't know if it's Anubis, I can't remember, but I wanted to try to have one of these animals, whatever. But it kind of shows that the kids, it's something that the kids would be worried about, and I thought it added more emotion. So they say accuracy never made for a good story.
Part 11 is justice. In justice, we have faith in the efficacy of our minds and the soundness of our judgment. We are able to cut things out of our lives responsibly, make decisions ethically, and rely on our personal system of checks and balances. With justice, I really think of like a lack of sentiment, just a very clear eye for reality. Not a lot of feelings of like, oh, I wish it was like this, or if only it could be this way, like a real acceptance of what is. And this one was a little tricky in terms of like Disney movies, but I thought of Disney's Hercules, and you know, you have Hercules who's so pie in the sky and has these dreams of becoming a Greek god. And I think the characters of Phil and Meg are really like, keep your feet on the ground, dude. Like, we're living in Greece here. Like, let's just deal with the reality of this. So you can see this pop up in different characters who are a little more level-headed and clear about what's actually going on in the story. So yeah, there you go. That's justice.
So I focused in on Brigham Young's relationship to justice. And so in sort of the political theocracy of Utah. Paula, could you read that first quote?
Not surprisingly, the hierarchy was conspicuous in public office until the end of the 19th century. In the state of Deseret, 1849 to 1501, 51, the president of the church was governor. His first counselor was chief justice and lieutenant governor, and his second counselor was secretary of state. The presiding bishop and an apostle were associate justices, and other general authorities comprised 19.2% of the House of Representatives and 21.4% of the Senate. D. Michael Quinn.
Cool. And then this other quote is just like, there's a whole bunch of Brigham Young quotes where he's talking about consequences of sort of like, I don't know, just he's like, if you're a thief, this is what we're going to do to you. If you're an adulterer, this is what, in every one of them is pretty much, we're going to kill you and pour your blood into the ground. Go ahead and read this last one, Paula.
I was just worried about time. So. Okay, the time is coming when justice will be laid to the line and righteousness to the plummet, when we shall take the old broad sword and ask, are you for God? And if you are not heartedly on the Lord's side, you will be hewn down. Complete Discourses, Volume 2.
So you notice his vest is red, and I just kind of, that was, and that's all I have to say about that card.
The Hanged Man is card number 12. The Hanged Man can work on a few different levels, as any tarot card can, but first and foremost, I think of it as just seeing things from a different perspective, like literally turning things on their head and looking at them in a new way. But there's also an element of surrender, which comes from the fact that the Hanged Man is the card that immediately precedes the Death card. So I have written here, the Hanged Man is the act of giving something permission to die, and this can be a time of profound acceptance and detachment. In this place of non-action, receptivity, and surrender, we change beyond what we ever imagined possible, a change that could never happen by manipulating or forcing an outcome. And here I think of Alice in Wonderland kind of going into a completely topsy-turvy world and just having to surrender to it and be like, well, I guess everyone's mad here. I guess I'll just go along with it. That's kind of the spirit of the Hanged Man, where you're not so... The lesson in the medicine of the Hanged Man is to move away from a place of resistance and into a place of surrender so that you're initiated into what comes next.
So Joseph is killed at Carthage. His hands are open. I was going to make a slide for this, and I didn't. But in all the previous slides with Joseph, his hand is on one or a different source of power. It could be he's holding him his hand. Another one, he has a ring, which sort of means his promises of eternity that he would kind of give people. And there's another in the Fool card. He has sort of his hand on his chin, his sort of like inventiveness and genius. And he has another hand on the Bible. And let's see the other. Oh, and in the Hierophant card, he has his serpent cane. And then he has a hand by some keys, like the keys of the priesthood. And anyway, so in this card, his hands are open. He's lost all of his power, including the pistol. So there's an irony. As Paula reads this quote, just think about the pistol falling out of his hand.
I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, but I am as calm as a summer's morning. I have a conscience void of an offense toward God and toward all men. If they take my life, I shall die an innocent man, and my blood shall cry from the ground for vengeance, and it shall be said of me, he was murdered in cold blood. Joseph Smith.
And the next one?
Joseph Smith pulled his six-shooter from his pocket and snapped the pistol six successive times. Only three of the barrels, however, were discharged. I afterwards understood that two or three were wounded by these discharges, two of whom, I am informed, died. John Taylor.
Anyway, juxtaposing the quotes is kind of interesting. More than anything, this was such a really morally gray situation. They weren't in prison. They were in the prisoner's bedroom. They were being sort of protected from the mob. And Hiram also had a pistol that he smuggled in. Anyway, it's just a really crazy situation. And I just kind of, that, I guess that's it. Oh, the pistol is an example of, once again, historical accuracy not being perfect. The pistol actually fell on the floor in the bedroom, but I just included it to tell the story. So.
For card 13, we have Death. Because Death is a card that has so much fear and negativity associated with it, readers are quick to dismiss the grittiness of this card and explain it as rebirth or transformation. To do so does not fully honor the gravity of this card and cheapens the experience for people going through it. Yes, death facilitates transformation. Yes, there is a natural rebirth that this cycle enables. But for either of those to take place, the dying needs to happen. It's a significant loss, and even if it is graceful, dignified, and right, there is inevitable pain that accompanies it. So with the death card, I think of an ending that is inevitable, an ending that is natural and right, but nonetheless very painful and ultimately mysterious. We don't really know what comes after death. As you can see in the top corner, this is a deck called the Herb Crafter's Tarot, where every card is associated with a plant. Death is associated with marigold, which brings me to the movie Coco, which is what I thought of as the connection for death. In Coco, the main character, Miguel, journeys into the world of his ancestors who have all died. And through that process, there is a lot of recognition of loss, but also understanding that the way his ancestors behaved informs his life now. So there is kind of that life, death, rebirth cycle that goes on there. So that is death.
Okay, you're probably guessing death. Huh? Who would that be? Well, there's this crazy fascination with Porter Rockwell, right? In Mormon culture. So, he was known as the destroying angel of Mormondom. This is also sort of about the Danites, and I've thought about including them down below or something. It's something I haven't worked out. But you have Joseph over here. Notice there's a bishop in the death card over here. Joseph's over there, and kind of think about that as Paula reads the next couple quotes.
I sent Orne Rockwell, leader of the Danites, to kill Boggs, but he missed him, and it was a failure. He wounded him instead of sending him to hell. Joseph Smith Jr., as quoted by William Law in July 1887. Rockwell told the crowd in 1869, "I never killed anyone who didn't need killing." He was that most terrible instrument that can be handled by fanaticism, a powerful physical nature welded to a mind of very narrow perceptions, intense convictions, and changeless tenacity. In his build, he was a gladiator. In his humor, a Yankee lumberman. In his memory, a Bourbon. In his vengeance, an Indian. A strange mixture only to be found on the American continent. Author Fitz Hugh Ludlow.
Thanks, Paula. he sort of flaunted his reputation. That's what the flag's all about. And the Joseph's pose, I need to fix, by the way. I'm still tweaking a few things. He doesn't look exactly like Joseph, but he's in the pose of a famous photo of Rasputin. And I just feel like there was that kind of a relationship between him and Rockwell. So, okay.
After death, we have card 14, Temperance. In temperance, we are standing in the presence of our guides, angels, and ascended masters. We faced death and are standing in its afterglow, where fire and water blend, where the pain has burned off, and we are left only with the healing and lightness of what we've made room for. So with temperance, I do think the relationship, the fact that it's the card that comes immediately after death, is really crucial. In tarot, you kind of have these intense cards and these kind of rest cards, where the lessons are still, you know, enormously important, but they're a little more subtle. Temperance is kind of the time after where you're like, oh, okay, what just happened? You know, you're kind of coming to terms with the death that you just experienced. And I think of this as being similar to Simba in The Lion King after Mufasa's death, and how he leaves and goes off, and you know, he meets Timon and Pumbaa, and that's all great and everything, but it's kind of that time away where he can just sort of process and experience a little bit of relief from that intensity.
Temperance was a difficult card. There was a lot of things I thought about. I ended up focusing on sisterhood and the Relief Society. This is sort of Emmeline B. Wells being baptized. In my mind, it's her. It might not literally be her, but she was baptized in 1842 during the Nauvoo period. And well, anyway, so there's a lot of things to say. We're running a little short on time, so I might skip some of these quotes. But I wanted to show, these are the three women. Well, actually, the Three Graces is a really amazing motif from art history that goes way back to the Greeks and Romans. And here's just an example of the Three Graces. And the Relief Society has its three virtues, I think it's faith, hope, and charity, right? The motto is charity never faileth. Instead of this angel has wings, I think this is Michael, I'm not sure, but the angel has wings. Her wings are her sister's. And these are the three women that I kind of was thinking about. They were all sort of involved in, well, to a greater or lesser extent, the Exponent, the Temperance Movement, women's suffrage, and the Relief Society.
And then we have the devil. So back from kind of a little bit more of a rest, back into the fire with the devil. There's a lot of facing of kind of our own limitations, our own limiting beliefs, and what chains us. The devil is not a monster that jumps in our path, baring his teeth and snarling at us. Rather, the devil makes us think that he is our friend, that he alone protects us, understands us, comforts us, and keeps us safe. The moment we start to question this is the moment we begin to invoke our own freedom. So the devil is a very intense card because you're coming face to face with those chains. But the beauty of it is that only in facing them do you have any chance of actually freeing yourselves from them. So I think of the Hunchback of Notre Dame and the, oh my gosh, like ever since I was a little kid, the bad guy in the Hunchback who is kind of like Quasimodo's like keeper, caretaker in the cathedral is just so terrifying and has that very clear message of like, no, I'm your protector, I'm your friend, even though he's the one who is like the source of Quasimodo's oppression. So yeah, the devil is quite intense, but is a, whenever I see it in a reading, think of it as a really like potent opportunity for change and freedom.
Oh, who's the devil? This is kind of a card with a twist in it. You see William Law up here with the Exponent, the building, a bag with it written on the bag, Nauvoo Exponent written on the bag, the actual paper. But in my mind, from my research, he's not the devil. He's, maybe you could call him Lucifer, which there's a quote down here. Lucifer in Latin means the light bringer. He's the guy who shined the light in the dark corners. So Venus up here was, Venus is related to that Roman definition of Lucifer. So the devil is Joseph's actions catching up with him. And I love these quotes, John Steinbeck, power does not corrupt, fear corrupts, perhaps the fear of a loss of power is what corrupts. And then the Victor Hugo is just, and as you, most of you I'm sure know that Joseph had ordered the press be destroyed. And so this Victor Hugo quote, every diminution of the liberty of the press is followed by a diminution of civilization. Wherever we see the freedom of the press interfered with, there we see the nutrition of the human family interrupted. So, I mean, Joseph made a big crime, and it caught up with him.
For card 16, we have the Tower, and I like to think of it as though the devil was down in one of kind of the lower rooms of the Tower, and when the Tower is destroyed, the devil, those chains are severed. In the Tower is a prayer for freedom answered, whatever it takes. The willingness to do anything necessary is requisite, because the devil's wounds are deep, and the Tower will rip us open to our core to extract them. The Tower is the destruction, the unexpected and possibly untimely destruction of everything that you thought was solid. I often think of the Tower as associated with a wildfire and how, you know, it's incredibly destructive, but it can be renewing for the earth, similar to the film The Fox and the Hound, the fire that rips through the forest there that kind of crumbles everything down, burns everything away so that both the fox and the hound can go on and live their lives without that conflict between them that's as present as it once was. That's the Tower. Say that cheerfully enough.
Talked about this one already. Let's see. Paula, would you like to read that first quote?
The Nauvoo Temple's cornerstone was laid on April 6, 1841. It was finished during the winter of 1845 to 1846. The temple was only halfway completed when Joseph was killed. The temple was in service for less than 3 months before the Mormons were driven out of Nauvoo.
And then the next one.
Okay. The temple was destroyed and burned, and the stones of the temple were scattered like the bones had been cremated. And the temple, in effect, was dead. So the temple died. Boyd K. Packer.
Perfect. Thank you. It just obviously represents the end of the Nauvoo era and the loss of all their material goods before crossing the plains. So, I'm sorry, Sarah. This is just so crazy. This is a classifieds ad for the temple that I found while I was doing research. Before it had burned down, it was, you know, they left and it was there for a year and they tried to sell it. And this is, you know, a famous drawing of it after it had been burned and struck by, or burned and then knocked over by a tornado and then knocked over in the interest of public safety.
Gotcha. Okay, so for card 17, we have the star. This is kind of the rest after the devil and the tower. In the star, it's all about kind of realizing you're still alive. You survived the tower, and now you have this moment of stillness where you can choose to go on. We just got the shit kicked out of us by the tower. We are tired and broken and probably still covered in ash. When the last ember extinguishes itself, when the smoke clears, when the dust settles, we enter into the star. She is shimmering, hydrating, healing. And here I think of the Lamb Before Time. And in the Lamb Before Time, Littlefoot loses his mother in this, you know, deeply tower-like moment. And the choice to go on is a really difficult one. But through the tree star that is sort of an emblem of his mother, a little symbol of her love for him, he is able to understand that he has a lot of, that he still has more journey to go. And I think that's the real realization of the star, that your journey hasn't ended just because the tower fell.
So I think of this was a tricky card, but I think of it as, for me, grandparents' house. I'm a teacher at a high school. I know of so many situations where grandparents are swooping in, taking care of the kids while the parents are in jail or on drugs or at rehab. So I don't know. That's sort of the glimmer of hope that I focused in on. We have grandparents. There's a book out about the gardener parenting and carpenter parenting. So I kind of have nods to those two styles of parenting. And then the star, I'll talk about the star later, but there's a little girl behind the star. And I'll tell you about that later. Let's see. This is about spiritual creation before physical creation. That's a big Mormon concept. So we have like the blueprints of the star up here, and then the star's being built. Something I'm going to tweak, I haven't had the chance to do it, but there's a clock. I wanted to represent Father Time and Kronos, but I'm going to remove the hour hand and the minute hand, because later I'll show you, but this sort of represents the pre-existence as well. So. Oh,
do you want to talk about this slide?
Sorry, bonus slide. The star is the logo I've been using for the Mormon Tarot. The star comes from the scripture up here. I won't read it, but it's essentially that it represents the journey of the soul for Mormonism. It represents a downward coming being. We see it as representing Christ, but it could represent each one of us. And it represents being baptized by water, that's the blue, by the Spirit, which is white, and by blood, which is red. So that's what this star represents. And I made, in the temperance card, I made their dresses red, white, and blue to kind of represent that. And then the little girl is sort of representing, there's eight stars in the star card, and there's only seven here, but the little girl is like the eighth.
Card number 18 is the moon. The moon is a difficult one to describe because I feel like it's very much, the moon is about what's hidden. It's about kind of what can't be spoken. It's very much about our wildness, our instinct. And here I have written, the moon is a place of great depth and takes a long time for us to come to terms with, but it's always been a room in our house. Before we know the true function of the moon, it's easy to use it as a storage space wherein we throw everything we don't want, everything we don't know how to deal with, everything we're embarrassed about or fear we cannot show the world. By the time we consciously enter the moon, we find it full of these unpacked boxes of shame and secrets. Here we must heed Nietzsche's warning to be careful, lest in casting out your demon, you exercise the best thing in you. So I think the moon can sometimes get a bad rap because it is where we put everything that we don't want to look at, everything we're ashamed of. But in truth, like, the darkness is a beautiful time where, you know, certain animals, certain plants, that's their time to shine. And so as we come more in closer contact with our own darkness, our own shadow, we can come to see that beauty as well. I think of the moon as similar to being the nightmare before Christmas, where it's like everything is just a little bit like just turned 90 degrees and looks a little bit darker and more mysterious and maybe scarier, but there's still so much like life and love going on within the moon.
Okay, so this was a tricky card. I focused on Eliza. We've talked about Emma and the other three women in the Temperance card. Eliza's definitely plays a significant role in Mormon history. Her relationship with the Mother in Heaven from the hymn that she wrote, Oh My Father, a lot of people say that sort of intuition may have come from her experiences being essentially, Paula, could you read that last quote, actually?
There was a saint, a prophetess, a poet, an intellectual, seized by brutal mobbers, used by those eight demons, and left, not dead, but worse. The horror, the anguish, despair, hopelessness of the innocent victim was dwelt upon. What future was there for such an one? For her, no home life could open. All aspirations of a saintly virgin, that maiden of purity, had met martyrdom. Alice Merrill Horn.
So these, you know, people have kind of thought about her intuition about the Mother in Heaven and in the hymn was sort of came from this experience. So it's about a dimly lit path and sort of like you see a rough stone on the left and a polished stone on the right. It's sort of that experience of mortality, that Mormon idea of progression and improvement.
And with card 19, we have the sun. So we arrive at the sun after an extended period of darkness. You think ever since death, card 13, things have been in shadow. We arrive at the sun with a renewed appreciation for life and a hard-earned understanding of this card's value. We are fully awake to the precious healing nature of this oasis. With the sun, I think, you know, nothing is in shadow anymore. There's a lot of understanding, a lot of clarity, and there's a joyfulness to this card as well. I mean, you can see the colors that are used by different artists. There's a lot of oranges and reds and yellows and a real vitality that comes through this card, which reminds me of the genie from Aladdin, who obviously has a great understanding of the world and great understanding of magic, but also just brings kind of a joyful energy to all of, you know, his interactions. So that's what I see in the sun.
We have the sunstone and lots of rope symbolizing sort of ascendancy and exaltation and all that. And this is sort of a Jesus looking carpenter. They said he probably would have been a rock mason, stone mason, rather than a wood carpenter because there wasn't a lot of wood in Bethlehem. And I gave him sort of an Odin hat, which is just kind of a nod to Nordic mythology. So why not? Cool. We're running a little short on time, so I'm just going to go to the next one. Oh, I do want to say this. So the star, the moon, and the sun represent the plan of salvation ethos of Mormonism. So the star, the moon, the sun, preexistence, mortality, and exaltation.
Card 20, we have judgment. You could also think of this as resurrection or awakening. You can see in the traditional card in top center, you know, people arising from their coffins. We've not only reconciled all that we are, but we find it glorious. In judgment, we can see the light that shines through the cracks of our humanity and can do the same for others as a result. We are the person we work to become. We are awake to our life's work and are using our leadership to heal, uplift, and better the world around us. With judgment, I think less of like a particular story and more the archetype of waking up with Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, kind of being asleep for a very long time and awakening to a world where your path is laid out much more clearly and you're clear on it. You've awakened to that. I think that's everything.
And lots of striking similarities once again. This is the angel Gabriel on the left. There's a long story about the angel Moroni and the angel Gabriel and how, what's his name? If you want to know more about it, I'll talk to you out in the foyer or outside. So from the tops of the mountains, that scripture in Isaiah, I have the Ochre Mountains in the background, sort of representing, and it shall come to pass in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the tops of the mountains. And so, yeah, there's Moroni, and I use doves to sort of represent the resurrected beings over here in the judgment card on the left.
This is our last card, and then we'll just dismiss right after this card, I guess. So card 21, we have the world, the final card, the culmination of everything. The world invites us to bask in our contentment. The world's vantage point offers a clear view of the perfection in each ostensible misstep, mistake, struggle, and wrong turn. The product of this hindsight is both a sense of accomplishment and an awestruck humility at the immaculate workings of the universe. And here I think of The Lamb Before Time, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, and when our little, you know, band of dinosaurs finally makes it to the Great Valley and sees, like, we made it all this way, we're united. There's a great sense in the world of, like, coming into contact and being, you know, no divisions anymore, no divisions with their family, no division from their future. That's the world.
Okay, the world card. This was a fun card. It's called Temple Reflections, and I wanted to kind of represent the end of early Mormon history with the Salt Lake Temple. That kind of represents the completion of that sort of narrative arc. But I also wanted to sort of suggest the beginning of another chapter, and I wanted to suggest in some ways another fool card. And this is in some ways a fool card for the next chapter. Not to say that she's a fool, but hopefully by now you should know what the fool card's about. So she's facing the temple at the reflecting pool. The pool is actually there. I'm sure you've been there. It's funny that it's an elliptical-shaped pool in the shape of a Vesica Pisces or a mandorla, which is an almond shape, or the Jesus fish, which is an ichthys. All of these are used in modern times to represent Christianity, but they have origins in goddess worship, which is kind of interesting. And I just was, my mind was blown when I realized the symbolic architectural imagery that's already there, of female geometry and male geometry, a fence between them. The idea of a yoni and lingam, which is right here, is a yoni and lingam. It represents sort of the balance, the unity of the female and male. And so this came after the fact, but we have sort of the illusion, the tower reflecting in the Vesica Pisces. So it's sort of a mirage or an illusion of the yoni and lingam. And then the kind of like a modern reference is kind of a key to the whole fool card. Is this sculpture called Fearless Girl by Kristen Visbal. So, and we come to the end. There we go. You guys have made it. Thank you so much for your attendance. This was a lot of fun. So here's Sarah's information if you want to contact her at Cottonwood Tarot and MormonTarot.com. My other website is JoshuaBaird.com, and you can visit my Facebook site. Thanks a lot. We'll take questions out in the hall if any of you want to talk.